My name is Mark Kretzman. The title of the session is Recent Japanese Economic Miracle. I am new to Holden, and the first session I was able to attend was this morning when I heard Pastor Nakamura give his presentation. And it put me a little bit at ease because of the wonderful participation and the knowledgeable audience that came tonight. I see some of the same faces that were at that meeting. He began by telling a little bit about himself, and I will do that as well. I first went to Japan in 1968 as a Prince of Peace volunteer, the youth organization at the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church. And I stayed there for 3 years at that time, taught mostly in a private university in Tokyo, Meiji Gakuin University, which was actually one of the scenes of some of the most, not violent, but some of the most interesting demonstrations against the American-Japanese Security Pact. We had a lot of vacations when students occupied the administration buildings and such like that. We were also very active with, that was of course the height of the Vietnam War, and we had many American GI deserters coming through Tokyo in various disguises. And there was one Japanese organization, the Beiheiden, which befriended many of the soldiers and gave them new identities and sent them packing off to Sweden usually. Those are very exciting times in Japan. I came back to the United States for another 3 years, and then in 1974, I went back to graduate school in at Sophia University in Tokyo, and finished a master's degree in Japanese literature. I'm one of the few authorities on one of the most obscure Japanese poets who ever lived. During that time, I did a lot of freelance interpreting. I wrote movie reviews for the Japanese language Rolling Stone magazine. I was a freelance studio banjo player. All this shows that I have a lot of difficulty holding down a job. I came back, I met my wife over there at the end of that stint, and we came back together to the United States, and in 78, we were living in Chicago, and in 1978, in Chicago, the Japanese Ministry of Education opened up a full Japanese day school that Pastor Nakamura mentioned this kind of thing in this morning session, where the Japanese have gone around, and because of the emphasis placed on education, have decided that for the people they send over to the United States and elsewhere, it's a good idea, they feel, to have Japanese schools. Prior to this, there are day schools, there are Saturday schools really all over the country where the kids go to an American school Monday through Friday, and then they spend their Saturdays brushing up on their Japanese characters and Japanese studies. But at that, I think there may be one more now. Until recently, there's really been only two full-time day schools in the United States, one in New York and then this one in Chicago. I was hired to teach English and American Social Studies, which is the only course which was not a part of the actual Japanese curriculum. I did that for a little over 3 years, and we moved up to Wisconsin, and I was hired back to Chicago by an organization called JETRO, which is Japan External Trade Organization. They are it's a 25 or 30 year old organization, which was originally, it's part of the Japanese government, and it was originally established to help the Japanese export their products all around the world. It is staffed primarily by the powers held by one of the most powerful bureaucracies in the world, the Japanese Ministry of International Trade and Industry, MITI. But within the office itself, there are representatives of some of the other bureaucracies, the agriculture and forestry bureaucracy, ministries these are. And things like that. So it's sort of the tentacle, one of the tentacles of the Japanese government, primarily trade oriented. I want to say a word about this because we're talking about it. I promised to mention the word economics here once in a while. The JETRO itself, as I said, was instituted originally to help the exports, and as we all know, they were eminently successful in that endeavor. So much so that it's caused a lot of problems, and these are the trade frictions that we hear about so often. The Japanese government, you perhaps might be surprised to hear, is actually fairly concerned about the trade imbalance between the United States and Japan. They feel that the United States is their best customer and their best friend. The Japanese have very few friends around the world, which we'll talk about later. But the United States is really one of the best, and of course their major market. So that even though they're so successful exporting, the Japanese government feels that their thrust at this point should be in the opposite direction. So a lot of what we do out of the Chicago office is really help Americans try to break into the Japanese market, help try to sell, give guidance is how that's done. So after this session, if any of you have a product that you just don't know how to break in there, let's talk about it. I want to throw this open because I was so interested in Pastor Nakamura's session this morning and how everyone, a lot of the people in attendance had some good ideas and their own ideas and a really breadth of experience that was really refreshing. So I do want to throw this open very quickly, but just a couple of other quick preliminaries and which have nothing to do. I just was calculating as I was walking down here, it takes me, we came from Wisconsin, but even just getting on the plane in Chicago, and we flew good connections to Wenatchee and then like that, it took me a little over twice as I can get to Tokyo in less than half the time that it took me to get to Holden here. And these are, to keep these in mind for later on. Plus, of course, you have telephone. You can sit and punch 13 numbers on the dial, and you're straight through to Tokyo. I don't know how Holden gets the newspapers, but we get, in our office, we get same-day Tokyo newspapers, which are flashed across by satellite and come down and are printed in the United States off the satellite, the satellite editions of the Asahi Shimbun and the others. So in a way, I don't know, you can take that. Okay, Japan is a very small country. It's an island country. It's a little bit smaller than the state of California. And it has 120, 130 million people. In other words, imagine taking half the people of the United States and throwing them into California. And it's worse than that because it's more crowded than that because, like California, which I don't know that much about, they say 90% of the land area is virtually uninhabitable. It's all mountains. Now, this is really funny saying this to Holden people because if you think of what that means is they're taking places, if Holden was in California, this would be one of the uninhabitable parts, right? Whereas on the other extreme, Los Angeles is considered habitable. Now, we might have our own opinions about that kind of breakdown. But anyway, most of the, 90% of the population, the very large population, lives along the coastal plains. This is the Tokyo, Nagoya, Osaka belt over to Kobe, and then and some around the other islands there. And I'm going to go into some generalizations here, but and one more preliminary, we need a general disclaimer. I think that after I lived perhaps in Tokyo, I think the high point of my knowledge about the Japanese came about when I was there for about 2 years. After, right at that point, I think I knew that everything, all the theories about how the Japanese think, how the society works, everything kept falling into place, and it made a very nice pattern. as you go along and as you do sort of more things and you get meet more people, you find more exceptions to this. And the things that sounded so neat and pat at first begin to break down. So now when I will be saying things about the Japanese, I have to include my wife, and she doesn't fit a lot of these categories. I have to include, you know, some very, very good friends. I even have to include my children, who, thanks to a little liberalization in the law, now have their Japanese citizenship as well. So my general disclaimer is, please remember that stereotypes, even going across, as Pastor Nakamura pointed out today, across cultures, whether it's Thai or Korean or Japanese, of course are very dangerous. And it's also sometimes not productive to even take 120 million people and assume that they're all alike either. I mean, there are so many variations. So we're going to be talking in very, very large strokes here today. And I want you to challenge anything that doesn't seem right to you. The miracle is another word that is a problem, and in many of these cases, there are pros and cons. I admired, again, Pastor Nakamura is talking about the Asian students who do so well in school and bringing out there is a real downside to this. And in many of these things that we'll be talking today, there's an upside and there's a downside. And in many cases, you can sort of take either side. I think it's best to sort of point out both. The word miracle, for example, there are people who say, what's so miraculous about an Asian country being as successful as the United States or European countries? The fact that we might consider this a miracle, isn't that a little prejudice on our part? They go back and say, if you look at Japan, in the early 1800s, they already had a literacy rate of over 50%, which far outstripped any of the European countries. They already had a city, Tokyo, which was one of the largest in the world, well over a million people, and a lot of the technology and a lot of the structure that goes with a big city was already well known, in many cases much earlier than in Europe. If you look at some of the other technology, mining goes way back in Japan. They had the technology to dig the mines and to extract them to keep the water from coming in, as well as very, very advanced irrigation techniques. So that there really is a base, so that in some ways it's not a surprise that Japan is where they are today. That's one side of that. The other side is that in World War II, this country was wiped out, just decimated. And so if you want to use the word miracle, I think that you might want, that's what it means, sort of, in a 30 or 35 years, they've come from, they were reduced to nothing and came back. And to go through a little bit of that right now, well, let's throw that one up. Let's try three or four reasons for the Japanese economies, or the countries, really. How did they get back on their feet after really being decimated in World War II? And we've heard a couple of these reasons this morning, but can you shout some out?
Do they really work harder and smarter? Than we do? You hear that, you know. They're more dedicated.
Okay, we can take this one. The longer, I think, is a better word than harder. What this builds into, and we'll get into this kind of thing, they're dedicated, yes. There's a different relationship between especially a Japanese man and his company. It goes into what you've heard of lifetime employment and the commitment that is made both on the part of the person hired and on the part of the company. A couple of years ago, I went around with representatives of very, very large construction companies mainly, and steel companies. We went around to USX and some names you would, GenCorp. Anybody know what GenCorp is? That's General Tire. It used to be General Tire. We went to about half a dozen companies who used to, U.S. companies, who used to make products. And with the downturn in heavy industry, they diversified. That's at one point, U.S. Steel, you know, was one of the top petroleum companies in the world. Then they decided that was too embarrassing, so they changed their name to USX. General Tire used to make tires, and now they're GenCorp, and they you know, serve food on airplanes and things like that. But what the Japanese wanted to know was, okay, when you hit these tough times, how do you deal with it? And we went to the American executives. It was almost textbook bottom line oriented. They went for their priority was in the profits of the company, and people were laid off. The Japanese had come there wanting to find different kinds of answers, because their top priority was, how do we keep our people working? What can we do? Can we diversify into a related field where our own employees already have some measure of training so that they can maybe adapt to this over here? Whereas the U.S. company, they might diversify, but that wasn't one of the priorities that their present workers could go over there. They were willing to fire their present workers and hire some new ones as long as it made, quote, economic sense. The Japanese priorities were different. There's a lot to be said about this. Lifetime employment is a contract. It's an ideal. It's important to talk about, but it's also important to know that it really only affects about 38% of Japanese workers. That there's a lot else, there are a lot of other things going on in the Japanese economy that don't quite fit this pattern. And there are a lot of things that make this possible. And we'll go to some of the downsides. How can they get away with this? You know, the Japanese corporations and industries have down cycles and up cycles, just as Americans. How do they manage to hold on to their workers and guarantee them lifetime employment? Any ideas? If you are,
they have a lot of suppliers who supply specific things that you don't have.
That's one, exactly. You limit the number of people that they call their, say, your official employees, who are the recipients of this lifetime agreement. And as much as you can, you outsource or you have suppliers. And when a pinch comes, often these large companies, large automobile manufacturers or heavy industry companies, their own employees won't feel it, but they'll be able to shift that downstream and really put the pinch on their suppliers, who are dependent on these large companies. Exactly, that's one. Their subcontracting system is one reason why they can hold on to lifetime employees. Anybody? Yeah.
They don't do much headhunting, and they don't pick people up from other companies. So if you lose your job, your lifetime job, it's hard to get into another one.
That's right. There's much less labor mobility. You're right. People don't quit and try to go the other one. That is not. It's frowned upon. It's like a divorce for them, and which divorce is frowned upon as well. Less labor mobility. A couple other ones. One is women. They utilize women employees, generally fresh out of college, who come in and do a lot of work for an average of 5 years, and they then leave the company and get married and raise a family and take over the education responsibilities and the household responsibilities. They still maintain a lot of responsibilities. But as far as the company is concerned, they don't have to promise a lifetime employment to women. They don't. And they get a lot of benefits out of it. This helps. In other words, when a contraction in the economy would come, you can lay off the women without affecting the lifetime employment of the males that you've hired on this promise. And I'll just throw one more in. In the same way with part-time work, By a high utilization of part-time work, you can keep the number of official employees down to the minimum, so that even in a downturn, you have something to keep them busy, and you can just keep laying off your part-time work. Yes.
Don't they also tend to go into training cycles during downturns and start and do continuing training of people to prepare them for the next cycle?
Yes, that's right. I suppose there's some extent of busy work, but the real extreme when an industry has really hit hard times, I consider this the extreme, is that to keep their workers working, they loan them out to companies in other industries. Automobile workers for Toyota, I don't know if Toyota's had a downturn for a while. The steel industry is a better example. When the steel industries were really bad, they would loan them out to the auto industries, to Nissan and Toyota that were working full time. Well, we're bringing a lot of things in here, and I hope you can see that there's a little bit of a different system involved here. That kind of thing would be unthinkable in the U.S. economy. That kind of loaning employees, there's a good deal of cartelization that's going on and all this. But anyway, pointing out the lifetime employment and the contract that an employer, that a worker has with his company. We had a guy in our office. We have one service that our office provides is a big company, all the companies that you've heard of, come over to the United States, and they have the resources and the personnel to go about their business and do their joint ventures and whatever all by themselves. They don't need us. But as far as with the services we provide to small and mid-sized Japanese companies, one thing is in our office we have a series of cubbyholes with each supply with a desk and a telephone. And a person can come over and utilize that very, very cheaply, almost for free. Usually they come over to sort of do a little market research, decide whether it's the time is right for their company to jump into the American market. Sometimes they come over, do that research, and go home. Sometimes they come over and it looks good, so they go out and open another office and stuff like that. But we had a guy about 2 or 3 years. He was here for about 2 years. He was a single guy, and he was approaching 30, which is the marriageable age, and where everyone in Japan, if you're a man at 30, everyone starts thinking of finding you a bride. While he was here, then he was called back to Japan for an omiai, which is the arranged marriage meeting. Now, it's not exactly like in the old times where the parents say, you marry her and you marry her. The people involved do have a say in what goes on. But, Americans do the same thing in sort of a less formal way. We might invite single people to the same party, you know, and let them take it from there. But it's not unheard of in the United States. But anyway, he went back and he met this woman and they exchanged photographs and they got along and they went out for a while and they were married. When I saw him again, I asked, how did they choose? Who is your wife? Who is she? How do you get to know her? And she said she was employed at one of the suppliers of his company. What had happened? His company made machines that made cardboard boxes, and her company supplied some parts of that machine. Anyway, in Japan, the suppliers will call on the larger company usually about 4:30 in the afternoon. 4:30 in the afternoon means you can come into the office and you can talk a little business, and then you can go out and eat and drink. And this is the regular. You don't call on a client or somebody in the morning. A lot of the business is conducted at important business is conducted at night over dinner, over a lot of sake. So you can reconstruct the scene. They call this suppliers, the company that she was working on, their suppliers go to his company, they go out to eat, they're drinking around. You can't talk about business all the time. So the conversation turns that we got this guy, one of our people in Chicago, he's 31 or two, he's still single, and the supplier says, we've got a secretary in our company, and she's been to the United States. It's a match made in heaven, right? So the fact that she had been to the United States for whatever reason sort of made these two the perfect match. And they went back, and the wedding, they had this big wedding, and you hear very much of families being, when two people are married, it's not just the individuals, the whole families are involved. But this is, you go one step beyond, these companies were involved. The master of the ceremonies at the wedding was the company president of the bride's company. He was the official master, he did all the work. The honorary master of ceremony for the match was the company president of the guy's company. Okay, now look at this relationship between the supplier and the parent company. See, this isn't just business. It's not just business. It's not just yen. This is a really networked society. Suppose in the next after that, an American company or even another Japanese company comes to that Mr. Kato's, the bridegroom's company, and says, look, we can supply you with the same thing that company is supplying at about 10 yen cheaper. I mean, do you think they're going to jump at this? Of course not. They're going to either shoot them out the door, or at worst, later on, that company president or purchaser is going to go over to the other company and say, you got to help us out. We got this other offer. They say they can do this thing for about 10 yen a piece cheaper than you can. Can we work something out? But the idea is that economic relations in Japan are not a matter of a yen or two. I mean, that's what the Japanese say. That economics business is a part of life. It's so cold-blooded to make decisions like this based solely upon, you know, this person can do it cheaper, when you're going to throw away all these personal relationships, you're going to disregard friendships, you know, like this. And what we're saying here, I mean, we're talking about the concept of free trade, right? I want to say on the other side of this, it's not an unknown idea in the United States either. We live in Wisconsin, and there's a little, employs about 35 or 40 people, little plant out in Sauk City, Wisconsin, and they make the casings, the outer shells for Rayovac batteries, AA's, C's, and D's. The machines for all their lines, they have about four lines, are Japanese machines. So every time they put in a new line, the Japanese engineers come over and show the American engineers how to operate the machines and stuff like that. They asked me to come and interpret for this. And this is of course one of the easiest interpreting jobs you can have, because the Japanese engineers and the American engineers are standing around a machine, both they know inside out, right? And all they don't even talk, they just point. the American engineer more often than not will anticipate what has to be done to make this adjustment. Anyway, there's a common language in the machine, which is just fascinating to watch. That's not what this story is about. But every time he comes over, in addition to putting a new line in, they go around and check the other lines, and the Americans say, we've been having problems with this, and to make a battery shell, the most important thing you have to do is to keep that gap consistent, because at Rayovac, then they put the battery in there, you know, very fast and automated, and if it's too wide, they can't close it, and if it's too narrow, they can't get the center of the battery in. So that's their problem all the time. And every time a Japanese engineer comes over, he says, you use this American steel. We use this stuff over in Japan. We couldn't even make batteries there, because the steel isn't. It's not that the steel is inferior, but that there's too much variance in the temper. Real hard steel will spring back too much, and such like that. And in one batch of steel, you can't be adjusting those machines continuously, so you get all these problems. But his point is, why don't you use Japanese steel? And for several years in a row, he said, you use Japanese steel, these machines will run perfectly. And finally, this last, it was about two times ago, he said the same thing, and I asked the company president, Don, what would it cost you to change over to Japanese steel? And he said, well, you know, last time Kano-san was here, we looked into it, and at that time to switch over to Japanese steel would be about 6% cheaper than the American steel. So, Don, what is stopping you? And he said, well, when we were just starting up, we got our steel from this ball company in Chicago, and it was a new company, and they extended us about $200,000 worth of credit right from the start. And we feel now that we're up and going and things are really, really clicking, that we just can't cut them off. So now this is restraint. This is not free trade either, right? This is what Business Week and the Wall Street Journal say is letting other considerations sort of taint the waters of what we consider fair trade. The economic miracle. You have any questions?
You just alluded to one of their advantages of the rest. They are more interested in quality control than we are, too, isn't that right?
Very much so. And they found a way to do it. They took an American's, Deming's idea of statistical quality control and taught it to everyone. And believed it, and this one of the closest things to a religion over there. They feel that, and rightly so, it's justified in economic terms that it's cheaper to spend money to make things right the first time than the other way. I want to get back to along with quality and along with company loyalty, there are some other things that are sort of dear to my heart. One is the income distribution differences in Japan as compared to the United States. Several years ago, they did a study and found that it was Toyota, that really the top man at Toyota at that time, I have to say only made seven times as much money as a new employee. Well, let's think of Roger Smith at GM. I mean, how many times more does he make than an employee? In other words, they have, I think, one of the keys to keeping people happy, if that's how you want to say it, is trying to keep a lid on that kind of rich and poor wealth distribution, and they've been very successful at that. Surveys done by the Prime Minister's office continue. It's going down a little now, but the majority, 90-some percent of Japanese consider themselves middle class. And the new wrinkle in that is they break that down into upper middle class, middle class, and lower middle class, and they're now seeing a little bit of divergence in the middle class is disappearing. But the income distribution has been very well maintained. And they've done it, one thing is because at the end of the war they were wiped out, and really everybody was, you know, back to zero. So you started from a pretty equal distribution there. And then they tried to maintain it. I have to say, and some of the organization of these talks is going down the drain. But one of the current problems is that they have gained so much from this, and they have tried to maintain it so much that it's almost, it is a shame that it's going down the tubes now. And the reason is because of the infamous high land prices in Tokyo, that all of a sudden Japan is developing a super rich class and then everybody else solely on the basis of whether you happen to own any land or not. And it's causing a lot of distortions not only there but around the world when all of a sudden rich land-owning Japanese have the capital to bid up land prices in Hawaii, to bid up land prices even in around Chicago and such like that. That this kind of problem, this kind of distortion is causing a real problem. I heard one of the, there are a number of these, you never really know how true they are, but it used to be that one I heard was that the land in the center of Tokyo is a very spacious imperial palace. And that land at market value was estimated to be about worth the entire state of California at one point. Another estimate is that the Japan archipelago itself, if you could sell that and buy North and South America and get some change, I suppose. But there are just some astounding things going on as far as some astounding distortions, and they had their impact, and I was hoping we'll get into some of those as we go on. Yes?
What about the labor competition part of it? American labor can't compete with Japanese labor because of the cost, and we have gone over there and we can go to a better product cheaper and bring them back over here and sell it here for a cheaper price. Is this true or not?
It used to be true.
For U.S. labor, in other words.
It used to be true. Japan is no longer a low-cost labor country. That used to be their main advantage was, and according, this is back to the economic miracle. There were a number of advantages. Let me sort of backtrack and work right back up to that. We mentioned they were, even though wiped out after the war, what you need to be successful economically. A couple of things happened, and the more you think about it, maybe the less miraculous they sound, but one of the things was political. The Cold War, the U.S. got into the Cold War mentality with the Soviet Union, and all of a sudden, Japan became a very important Asian base. They felt that a healthy, economically healthy, but not militarily healthy, economically healthy Japan would be an ally of the United States, would be a good counterbalance to what was perceived as a Soviet threat. So there was, the recovery was funded by U.S. capital. It was fueled by U.S. technology. And it was even purchased by, all of a sudden, sad but fortuitous for an economic recovery, the Korean War breaks out. And here all of a sudden is a ready-made market for the heavy industry that that Japan was getting into. I'm going to get your, I want to, you know, you ask the Japanese are taught this, but there's a little bit of revisionism going on now. That Japan is a very resource-poor country, and in spite of that, the diligence of the people have brought about this great economic miracle. I agree with that it's the diligence of the people cannot be underestimated. But there are people now who are starting to look at this resource-poor versus resource-rich idea, and there are some people who even say that actually when things are in surplus and when things are cheap, that it's an advantage to be resource poor. And like an example, during a war, if you have a brother-in-law who owns a foodstuff store and there's a shortage of foodstuff, well, he might take some fruit or something and save it for you because you're relatives, and this is a great advantage, so to speak. On the other hand, if there's a real surplus of everything and the commodities are low priced, and across the street you have a supermarket or a Kmart or something, and he's got this little store over here, actually it's cheaper to go over there and buy it, buy the commodities very cheaply. But you might say, well, since he's a relative, I'll still do my shopping over here. In other words, it's an economic burden to have that kind of thing. And they're looking back at this period of development in Japan, and they're seeing that what happened was in the early 50s, this is exactly the time that the major oil fields were discovered and began to be developed in the Mideast. And the central role of the cost of energy is what this is all balanced upon. Even though Japan had no resources of their own, with the cheap oil all of a sudden, the transportation of resources, commodities, into Japan became very, very reasonable and economically feasible. What happened? Not only did oil energy itself become cheap, but due to that, for example, the discovery of nylon, pre-war, but it was too expensive because petroleum was too expensive to really develop that. All of a sudden, with the cheap with cheap petroleum, the utilization of nylon and other synthetic and plastics and fabrics became much economic feasible. Then what happens is the price of cotton goes down, and it's a chain reaction. In fact, they look now at the Australians who were producing cotton at that time. When the bottom drops out of the cotton market, they turn to beef, and the price of beef goes down. All of these things actually work to the advantage of a place like Japan. You go back to West Germany at that time. West Germany had a thriving coal industry, and when the market for coal with this cheap petroleum, when the market for coal bottomed out, they were stuck because they had a huge investment in this type of energy. And layoffs in the coal mines would cause immense social problems. So what the government did, what they had to do was subsidize the coal. They made laws that government projects and such as this had to use so much coal and had to be native coal and stuff like that. In other words, it was an economic burden to have those resources. In much the same way, the oil that was in the continental United States, they just couldn't cut that loose, and even though Middle Eastern oil became cheaper, it was actually expensive for the United States to keep subsidizing that. So the point is that there are a number of factors that really dovetailed to make this possible. The Korean War with the supply of the market, the U.S. Felt that it was suddenly in the U.S. interest to supply the capital and the technology. They had this energy became cheap, and it was cheap to import the materials. And if you look at the specific industries that fueled the Japanese recovery, they started with very, very resource-intensive industries. They went steel and shipbuilding. I mean, if you think about this, they had to import huge amounts of ore and steel and shipbuilding. You batten these things on the ship. What could be more intensive? So they were able to get their materials cheaply, and they had the labor, and they had the dedication and the workforce. And I promised to get back to your question, and I forgot what it was. Where are we?
The cost of labor.
Cost of labor.
And mentioned the merchant marines, a good example of that. We lost our merchant marines because it's too expensive to build ships, and we couldn't afford to pay the sailors and people. And we don't have any merchant marine now, but Japanese.
Originally, Japan was a low cost labor country, and that they used that to their advantage. Exactly. What has happened now is the shoe is on the other foot, because Japanese labor costs now are higher than the United States, which is one of the reasons that you find so many Japanese companies locating in the United States, the other reason being close to their major market. But a couple years ago, I think it was Business Week, called attention to the hollowing of the American corporation, where the U.S. companies were moving their manufacturing facilities to a variety of places overseas or Mexico, where the labor costs were cheaper, and there all what was left in the United States was sort of this hole of administration, and it was felt that this was unhealthy. Well, the same thing is happening to Japan. Many things that you associate being made in Japan now, the VCRs and the and cameras and such, many are assembled in Taiwan, Korea, and other Southeast Asian countries. The focus here is on Asia, and I want to over the years, I've been very, very fascinated with a lot of Japanese things. I've been attracted to, and I still am, the depth of the culture and tradition. You learn things, amazing things all the time. It's really one of the least attractive areas, although it's all interconnected, is what we're talking about today, is the economic side of this. It's an important one, but it was never one that I was really, it's not an attractive side. One really little bit too simplistic way of looking at it, but I think valuable in a sense, is if you look at the United States relationship to South America, and if you look at the European relationship to Africa, those relationships are very, very parallel to Japan's relationship with the rest of Southeast Asia, with the rest of Asia. The word imperialism springs to mind, and it's an applicable one. It used to be, what it is that all of these, Japan's relationship with all these other countries is very, very strange in many ways. But for example, it used to be in Europe that if you wanted to travel in Africa, if you wanted to travel from one African capital to the capital of the country next door, you had to fly to Paris. You had to fly to Paris and come back, because the European, in that case French, connection, the French relationship was the primary one, and that's the one there. And there was no sort of regional consciousness or regional cooperation. That is, in many ways, the kind of thing that goes on in Asia. Although, of course, you have now organizations and such like that. But Japan, Japan is not loved in Asia, of course. And there's a war history to. Which is easy to understand, but there's more than that. There's an economic domination. There's the attitude of the Japanese, which would be fun to get into. There's a number of ways to get at this. Uchi and Soto, there's the us and them mentality of the Japanese. I think in many ways the United States and Japan have sort of opposite approaches to a lot of things. For example, they say Americans look around, North Americans look around the world, and all they see are potential Americans. Anybody can come to this country, and even though there are difficulties to overcome and different types of experiences, well, we have examples of those all around. The Japanese, on the other hand, have a tendency to think in it. Well, that type of thinking is that the extreme of that, the danger of that, is thinking that everybody else around the world thinks like we do. You know, that you know how people behave, or you know how people think. It's a little bit arrogant in that sense. The other side of arrogance is, I think, the Japanese side, in that we are unique, and that nobody can understand us. And there is a peculiar Japanese way of doing things. And those are the two extremes, and they're both sort of dangerous. You'd hope there'd be some sort of combination or some sort of middle ground there. But it leads to a lot of problems. The current problem is, one current problem is how to deal with the remilitarization of Japan. There are people in the United States who, at this point, say, Japan has received a free ride on defense matters for so long. They are under the nuclear umbrella shield of the United States, and they have used this opportunity where they don't have to make a lot of outlays for their own defense. They've used that, funnel that into their economy, and they're getting a free ride on that. That's a really complicated issue, and it's one that I was sort of wished I was wanted to talk about tomorrow on when you get to U.S.-Japanese relations. But you can come down on either side of this. You can say, yes, that's true. The other side, a couple of things you can do. You can recount the Japanese contribution to their own defense, and if you really look into that in terms of the land that they are giving the Americans and such like that, it's actually a sizable contribution that they are making. The other side of that is, does this world need a remilitarized Japan? The Prime Minister of Singapore is fond of saying that the Japanese have always been better warriors than they are merchants, which is a frightening thought. I'm rambling, because somebody bring you back with a question here.
How long will it last? You know, if you'd say this miracle, this big boom, does it have a real longevity, or is it, you know, America's on top, Japan's on top, next China?
There are a number of opinions about that. One thing you can say is the genius of what the Japanese are good at, to me, I don't know a lot of other cultures, so I don't want to be extreme about it, but it seems to me that these people are some of the best organized culture, or one of the best organized cultures around. I mean, other people have said that, for example, I mean, just silly things like you put 10 people together on a project, and regardless of sort of the educational level or whatever, that, you know, 9 times out of 10, the Japanese group will get themselves organized and get this done ahead of more individualistic American groups or more individualistic even Korean groups and things like that. The first step is to sort out the pecking order. Japan is a vertical society, and I think this is, if you don't remember anything else, this is one key to looking at it. Everybody has a place in this society. There is a pecking order. I took one, this won't hold water here at Holden, I'm sure, but I took a course by a Belgian Jesuit whose pet theory, again, it was on the Japanese concept of time, but his pet theory was that originally, almost prehistoric Japan, if you went back and looked at where the villages were located, they had some fields down on the seashore, but because of the typhoons and such, they stayed away. They all lived in the mountains. And of course, you wouldn't live at the peaks, and there was too much snow in the valleys, so all the villages were sort of halfway up the mountains in this certain, what he felt was a developmentally important stage of Japan's history. And his idea was that you walked down the street and you either looked up or down, and so that everything took on this sort of vertical. The other side of that is there are also people who claim, for example, that perhaps Australians or even Chinese, there is a continental mentality, or that the geography of the place you live in shapes the way you look at things. I mean, you can say that, but the real question is, how does it shape the way you look at it? Anyway, it's a vertical society, everyone in its place. What this does is, and I want to talk a little about the concept of I. One person at the self-concept, one person counted up several years ago that there were 48 different ways to refer to yourself in the Japanese language. I don't know if it's 48 or not, but what is true is that you refer to yourself, the words you use for yourself vary depending on whom you're talking to. If you're talking to your parents or someone above you, use a certain type of word. If you're talking to your children, use another one. In other words, the individual itself varies according to the circumstances. A good example of that was one of the primary war criminals, war persons, who was a minister of war during World War II. After the war, he reemerged as a pro-American and was reelected. In our society, I remember when McGovern, started running for president, people would say, well, way back then you were in favor of the Vietnam War, and what he said, maybe 10 years ago, people wouldn't let him forget it. But in Japan, when the times change, it's okay to change with them, and that's expected. And that's what, and so, in fact, even in the words of surrender, the emperor said, not that we surrender to the Allied forces or we surrender to the United States or whatever, we surrender to the times, to the dictates of time. In other words, time brings the changes. There's a saying in Japanese that guests, like fish, begin to stink after 3 days. We might say, well, it depends on the guest. Some guests, they get on your nerves after 1 day, and others, they can stay for a long time. But no, the Japanese, the time brings the changes. We talk about time, for example, as we take time, we have time, we give time, we buy time. It's a commodity. I mean, we're the actors on that. In the Japanese language, it's much more passive. The time is the actors upon us. Things happen with time, and we roll with it. And this has nothing to do with it. I'll tell you what, it's getting close to... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, a lot of what you're saying has to do with real deep cultural stuff, right, that probably goes way back.
Mm-hmm.
And even the relationship to the rest of Asia and, the South mm-hmm. and all that. What did the war change? Did it change the society in any significant way?
There are two schools of thought. On the surface, of course, everything changed. The Constitution was written by American forces, made it a peace constitution. They're not allowed to export arms. They can manufacture a certain amount. And the GATI, the self-defense force, is established. The education system changed. The women received the right to vote. This is called the democracy, the democratization of Japan. And that's one side of the story. And you have to acknowledge the importance of all that stuff, because Japanese will just think in terms of the war as the great watershed. I mean, everything happened since the war, since this is a big watershed. There are other people, of course. You have a society that old, and you're exactly right. You go another layer deeper. How much has really changed? How much has really changed? How much is just a little more service? And people think that actually, when you look at attitudes and such like that, attitudes to Asians, attitudes toward blacks, not all that has changed. There's a lot more to talk about. Have you been to Japan? Has anyone been? There's upsides and downsides. I go and you're treated, and there people are so nice to you. And then you're down at immigration, you find, Korean people who are born and raised there in front of and back of you. What are they doing in the immigration line? Well, they're not treated as well as the white people are. They're not treated as well as black people are. Let me tell you, tomorrow I want to do a little more concentration on the U.S.-Japan relationship. And on Friday I have one more session that talks about Japanese education, and I'll be drawing on some of the experience I had in the school system then.